everyone, and welcome to Minute 102 of Season 3 of Movie Rob Minute, the daily podcast where we yippee-ki-yay our way through the 1988 Bruce Willis action film Die Hard, 1 minute at a time. I'm Rob, and joining me once again today is Dana Nachman, the award-winning documentary director who has some great films that everyone should go and try and watch. You know, you can find on IMDb, not just her links to the episodes of this show that she's been on, but you'll find there all the other movies that she's, you know, been the producer of, director of, and stuff. You look shocked. You didn't know that you're on IMDb for being on this show, are you? Did you?
I didn't. Am I really?
Yes, you are.
Really?
Yes, you are.
Look at that.
Sure.
I did not know that.
Well, not everyone goes to their IMDb page every day to check what's been updated there. Or maybe you do. I don't know.
I was just actually on it the other day, though, because my agent had changed and I realized it wasn't updated. So I was on it. I just didn't notice.
There you go. Well, when these shows come out, so you'll have a few more, you know. But you have at least, I know that I did the episodes from Planes, Trains, Automobiles. I'm trying to remember if I've done the backlog from Great Escape yet. But if not, it'll be there soon. You know, they will be there. So people who want you on their podcasts will be able to find you by seeing that, you know, that you've been on podcasts on IMDb.
Nice.
Yes. All right. So episode 102 begins with Al having a somber look and ends with Hans getting religious on everybody. So basically, yesterday we ended things, you know, Al told John his story about the traumatic experience that he had years earlier when he accidentally shot a kid. You know, he had an accident, which once again brings up the fact, and I've brought this up so many times, you know, this is a party line. He's opening himself up very emotionally and very vulnerable. He makes himself very vulnerable by the way that he's just telling this whole story. Like, you know, it would be one thing if it was just a phone conversation between him and John, but you know, anyone who's listening to this particular channel can hear this story. You know, Thornburg's gonna, you know, put it up on the news. You know, cop had you know, traumatic experience and refuses to use his gun. You know,
I don't know if you've talked about this yet in other episodes, but you know, often, even though things are public, people after a while forget. Like I know in my work, you know, we're shooting, you know, people start off very self-conscious about the camera, but then after like a certain amount of time, people forget even that the camera's there, even if they see it. And I think the same would be for a party line. You know, like any kind of hot mic mishap that you've ever heard about, people know they're mic'd, but they still, you know, reveal things. And so I think that could be the case here. They've been on this line for a long time. They stop being conscientious about it, you know, at some point.
Okay. It could be. But it's just, you know, for me, it's just very funny because, you know, a few weeks ago, you know, Hans interrupts a conversation by saying, touching, cowboy, touching, you know, because he was listening in on the conversation, you know, between John and Al at the time. And, you know, as the movie goes on, we're going to hear even more vulnerabilities from the characters. You know, when John thinks that he's not going to make it out and stuff like that, you know, the way that he will talk and stuff like that. So, you know, it's a ploy in the movie. The whole idea of the radio is a ploy in the movie to give us information. You know, it's not really there just to give, you know, John information about Al and Al information about John. It's to let the audience feel this bond between the two of them getting stronger and stronger because they're revealing so much to one another.
Right. But I think to me, it's plausible that it's their only way of communicating. So they don't have a choice and they're in such a dire situation that they have to get kind of real and intimate, you know, it lends itself to that. So I, you know, I buy it.
Right.
I definitely buy it.
Okay. So at this point, John responds to Al's story by saying, "Sorry, man." And Al responds, "Hey, man, how could you know?" John responds, says, "I feel like shit anyway." Well, then this won't matter. The LAPD is not calling the shots down here anymore. And then John says, "Feds, you got it." So it's also a nice way to give off this information. You know, we saw before that the Johnsons showed up, and we saw that they're starting to take control. But at this point, it's telling everyone definitively that, you know, the cops have no say whatsoever in anything that's going on here. We're just going to be dealing with, you know, with Johnson and Johnson, Big Johnson, Little Johnson, and, right. You know, whatever they decide, that's what's going to be. And as he's saying this, we see a shot of Robinson and both Johnsons walking up a huge embankment, you know, which we can also see that we see Al's car, you know, still hanging there up against the wall with the way that.
Yeah, I like that.
Yeah, it's on the one thing, it tells us the geographical location of things, you know, like from where they're standing, where his car, you know, went off the embankment and stuff like that. And the fact that people are still moving around there. No one has even tried to take this car off of the wall. You know, it's just funny seeing the angle of the car, the way that it's sitting there.
Yeah, I mean, from a production standpoint, I mean, it's a great shot because, well, A, it's like a pan, right? Which is interesting, like a pan from the building to the, and then, yeah, and like if you're, like, I don't know how, you probably know more, but like how many times has that shot been in the, like that shot could have actually been from another time, right?
No, they've never shown this shot before.
Interesting. But they could have used it before. Like, you know, it's interesting. They probably had it waiting for the perfect time. Like, it's
wait, you're seeing the shot of having the car leaning up against the wall? No, they haven't shown it since it happened. They haven't shown it.
So what did it look like? Did you ever see that car from that vantage point, that angle, or no?
No, only when it went off the embankment, and from now we're seeing it from the right hand side. When it happened, we saw it from the left hand side.
Yeah, interesting. So if you think about it, they shot that at a totally different time, right? They're not going to have that car there for long.
Right.
So like they were really planning this shot for this scene. Or they didn't plan it for the scene. They planned it for another time, and they just inserted it here. It's interesting.
Right. Yeah. No, but also, you know, I'm not going to right now go back and try and compare the angle of the car on both of these shots. You know, wondering if it's the exact same angle that they, you know, if they got it right from when it went off the embankment.
Yeah, the other shot. Of Al on the walkie right after that shot is an interesting shot too, because it's a pretty untraditional shot in my mind, because he's looking to the left, like you'd almost like want his face to be on the other side of the screen, on the right side, you know, it is following the rule of thirds, you know, which is with his the primary thing, but it's like almost like he's facing the wrong way. Or his face should be on the other side.
You're talking about John, right? You're talking about John?
No, I'm
Or you're talking about Hans?
Oh,
you're talking about Al.
Hans, yeah. Al, I'm talking about Al. Yep. At
right, it's second 23.
On the walkie. Yep.
Right, but John is shown right before that. So we see John on the left hand. We see the shot of the Johnsons and Robinson walking up, and it's funny looking at the way Robinson is walking behind them. He's walking as if he's like a little kid who's been scolded. You know, he's not really, it doesn't look like he's making much of an effort, you know, because he's no longer in charge, that type of thing.
Yeah.
You know, he's like, all right, I'll just follow these guys. That's what I have to do here. You know, and then after that, we see John on the left-hand side of the screen. And then we see right after that, Al, who's also on the left-hand side, but he's facing the left side, as opposed to John, who's facing the right side. So that's what we're talking about here.
It's interesting, but strange. Like, I almost think he should be moved to the right side of the screen, still looking off to the left.
Okay, but this minute, every single shot of Al is on the left hand side where he's facing off to the left.
Yeah.
So it's not just right there.
Interesting.
It's this right. This entire conversation is the way that he's doing this.
Yeah.
It's right. And then we get another shot of the three of the three top guys walking up that embankment, once again seeing the car, hanging on its side. And then the shot changes and we see Hans, Theo, and Christoph all just sitting there looking at something.
Yeah.
And then Theo begins to talk and he says, "All right, those are the city engineers. They're going into the street circuits. Those guys in the suits, I don't know who they are." And then Hans responds, "That's the FBI. They're ordering the others to cut the building's power. Regular as clockwork." And then Theo says, "Or a time lock." And then Hans responds, "Precisely. The circuits that cannot be cut are cut automatically in response to a terrorist incident. You asked for miracles, Theo. I give you..." And then he'll get cut off. We're going to have to wait until tomorrow to find out what he gives Theo. But he gives them something that will assuage this possible miracle. So let's go back a little bit to when we first see the three of them looking at this monitor. So we have Christoph in the back, who has like these goggles on his forehead. We saw before that they were drilling, so there were sparks and stuff like that. But it's just funny that he still has the goggles just sitting on his forehead like that. This is a character who we don't see very often, and it's just funny to have him sit in the back there with these goggles. Just, and he's also much further away from Theo and Hans, which establishes, that he's pretty much low man on the totem pole here.
Yeah. He looks like John Cusack, a young John Cusack there.
Yes, there is a resemblance there. And actually, if you want to talk about real comparisons, so John Cusack was in 16 Candles. And he and his friends, when they were at the party or the dance, so they actually had on goggles like this on their foreheads, didn't they? If I remember correctly. I'm pretty sure.
Oh, yeah.
So he does have a resemblance there, and again, this only came out a few years later. This wasn't, it wasn't a 30 plus year gap.
That's funny.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Now Hans also when he mentions that it's the FBI, he has this like huge smile on his face because he now knows that his plan is nearly perfect. He knew that this is what the feds were going to do, and they've done it. And since they've done it, it works great for him. He knows that everything that he set up is going to help him get to where he needs to go.
Right, like fed right into his hand.
Yeah, completely. Right into the plan that he created. So he mentions the term clockwork. It's regular as clockwork. So, Dana, what do you know about clockworks? Like, how does a clock work?
It's just very, what's the word I'm looking for? It's always the same, reliable. You know what it's going to, I think that's what the expression means. I don't know.
No, for sure. That's what the expression means.
Yeah.
I was talking about the mechanics of how a clock would work. Do you know anything about that?
Not really, no.
Okay, so the term clockwork. I'm sorry?
Gears, I don't know.
That's part of it. Yeah, it's part of it. So clockwork refers to the inner workings of either mechanical devices called clocks or watches, where it is also called the movement, or other mechanisms that work similarly using a series of gears driven by a spring or by a weight. Okay, a clockwork mechanism is often powered by a clockwork motor consisting of a mainspring, a spiral torsion spring of metal ribbon. Energy is stored in the mainspring manually by winding it up, turning a key attached to a racket, which twists the mainspring tighter. Then the force of the mainspring turns the clockwork gears until the stored energy is used up. The adjectives to wind up and spring-powered refer to mainspring-powered clockwork devices, which include clocks, watches, kitchen timers, music boxes, and wind-up toys. Okay, now, when do you think the first known example of a clockwork mechanism was used? How far back do you think this goes? You know, that someone was able to think of this idea of, you know, putting springs together and using gears in order to use something similar.
1827.
No, because much further back than that, it actually there are there is proof that it actually started in the first century BC. Okay, that they used it for calculating astronomical
Cool.
positions and eclipses, and it was recovered from a Greek shipwreck, and they found many other clockwork devices in ancient Greece, and the mechanism itself is sophisticated enough to indicate that a significant history of lesser devices leading up to this creation also existed. Okay, but for some reason in Europe, they forgot all about this idea. And for centuries, nobody had anything that was some sort of clockwork or whatever, until the Islamic world met up with the European world during the Crusades. And it took them another few hundred years till clockwork was able to reach the equivalent of the technological levels that they had back in Greece and Rome and things like that. All right. Now, apparently, if you look in the Bible, so they talk about the fact that Solomon, when he created the first temple, when he built the first temple in Jerusalem, so he used this type of wisdom to design a throne that had mechanical animals, which would hail him as king as he ascended it. And when he would sit down, an eagle would place a crown on his neck, on his head, and a dove would bring him a Torah scroll and things like that. So it's really cool to think about the fact that, you know, there's that this is something that's going really, really far back. Just the idea of being able to use this type of things. You know, in ancient China, there are things that there are tales of people being able to use clockwork back then also and stuff like that. So
Very
yeah,
cool.
they have
I
some
wonder
really.
when did the expression start?
Yeah, that I do not know. That I do not know.
That's what I
When,
wonder.
yeah, because I guess, you know, it probably was somewhat, you know, probably after like the 14th century when it started becoming so prevalent, you know, I guess people would start using. I don't know. So I mentioned that there are different types of mechanisms that use it. So we have wind-up toys. We have what are known as you know, leaf shutters. They use clockwork mechanism very similar to what you have in wristwatches in order to time the opening and closing of shutter blades. Okay, the lens of the lighthouses, the old time lighthouses, also before they used electric, where you would use clockwork with them. You have all these different mechanical calculations that they would use before they had computers. You know, computers were only really starting to be developed during World War II. So before that, they used mechanical calculators to figure out all these different complexities, you know, that nowadays we do with computers. Music boxes, as I mentioned before. Most phonographs that were built before the 1930s used clockwork also. And then you have clockwork radio, which is an energy store has an energy storing spring accounting for much of the size and weight of the device, and it spins a much smaller electric generator. Such equipment is very popular where batteries and mains power are scarce. So, you know, it's the type of it's a wind-up clock basically. You know, that type of thing. And then Theo mentions the fact of a time lock. Okay, so do you know what a time lock is?
No.
Okay, it is a locking mechanism commonly found in bank vaults and other high security containers. And the time lock is basically a timer designed to prevent the opening of the safe or vault until it reaches the present time, even if the correct lock combinations are known. You know, the idea that,
Oh.
okay, you can only open it at 8 o'clock in the morning or whatever it is, right? They're usually mounted on the inside of a safe or a vault door. There are usually three time locks on a particular door. The first one has to reach zero, and that allows access into the vault, and the other two are there for backup purposes, right? They were originally created to prevent criminals from kidnapping and torturing the people who knew the combination, and then using the extracted information to later, burgle the safe or vault. And it also would stop entry of unauthorized people or even authorized staff at unauthorized times. Okay, in how far back do you think the idea of a time lock in a bank goes? It's not as far back as the clockwork. I'll give you that hint. And you were close with your guess from before.
1811.
1875. So you went a little too far back. There you go. Right. Now, apparently there was a bank robbery in Great Barrington, Massachusetts,
Oh, I've been
where,
there.
oh, really?
Yeah.
Wow. Okay. Were you in the bank that was robbed?
I don't remember being in a bank. There's a good
Right.
movie theater there. There's a good restaurant there.
Oh, wow. Okay. So apparently some
Wouldn't it
bank
be funny if
robbers,
I saw Die Hard there? Which I
it
didn't,
would really be
but
funny.
yeah. I think I
You
saw Runaway Bride there.
Okay, that came out 12 years after Die Hard. So yeah. So basically a gang of robbers took a family of the banker hostage because they were demanding that he open the vault. And because they had installed a time lock in there just a few days earlier, there was no way of them ever being able to get into the vault in time, so they just gave up and left. And obviously, in this movie, we know that a time lock is very important to the whole plot, which is why Theo uses that phrase, because Theo is the one waiting for the time lock. I'm still confused about the fact that how does Hans know that this is the FBI's, plan? Like, I don't think even nowadays where we have the internet, you can't go onto the internet and say, okay, I'd like to know what the FBI plan is when you're dealing with terrorists or something like that. It's not, it
Well,
shouldn't
he's
be
that
common knowledge.
sophisticated of a terrorist that he knows because he's been so experienced.
Yeah. Okay. I guess that's the best answer we can get anyway here, because it's all conjecture anyway, because we really don't know where Hans gets this information from. I mean, I still am a firm believer that Hans is the only one who knows the entire plan. None of the other thieves or terrorists, however you want to refer to them, are really aware of every single aspect of it. I mean, here we have Theo, who's the computer guy. He didn't, he wasn't told beforehand how they were going to open the seventh lock. He was told, your job is to get through the six locks. Once you get through the six locks, we'll take care of the seventh lock. And, if that was me, and again, I don't have a criminal mind, so maybe that's part of the problem. But if that was me and I was told, okay, you do the six locks and I'll take care of the seventh lock, I would be very curious to know what they're going to do with that seventh lock. And I wouldn't want to wait until the day of the heist to find out, what's going to happen, because I would be concerned that, okay, it's not going to work. So, Theo has a lot of faith in Hans, that he has a good plan, even though he doesn't know what it is. So they do this well, the way that they, and
Agreed.
also one of the things I love about this dialogue with what Hans is doing, Hans is basically, once again, he's telling the viewer his plan. We didn't know how he was going to open the seventh lock, but now he's explaining what it is that needed to be done in order to open up the seventh lock. They're not just visually showing it to us. He's also, I guess, narrating it and explaining to us what it is that they're going to be doing. So my biggest question now is, okay, so Hans theoretically knows what the FBI does in these types of situations, okay? And apparently that means the screenwriter seems to know that he also he seems to think he knows the answer to that too. Do you think people in the FBI then watched this movie and said, "Oh, I think we got to change the way we do things"? Oh, how did they find that out?
Well, they seem to have their, they're not that with it. They're trying to create like a,
No, I'm talking about the real FBI. I'm not talking about the Johnson and Johnson. Yeah,
yeah,
no, it's a,
to be
for to me,
better.
it's always interesting to think about, like, how is real life affected by things that happen in movies and that are told in movies and stuff like that.
Right.
Because you know, when a screenwriter is writing something, they're going to be looking for some sort of flaw in order to, help something take place in the story. But here, when you're doing something like this, it could be that the screenwriter just completely made this up and it doesn't matter. And the people in the FBI are sitting watching this movie laughing, saying, huh, is that really what you guys think that we're going to do? We don't do that type of thing. We do something else.
Right.
So.
I would think it's not based in reality that much.
No, probably not. It's probably not. But
Yeah. But then, when you get
again.
into shows like Homeland or other things that seem much more rooted in reality, that, then I wonder, but like less so on movies like this or
Right.
like we said yesterday, Olympus Has Fallen or, things like that.
That's true. You probably would appreciate this a lot. I'm sure you noticed that when Hans is talking at the end, it's a really, really it's we get a very big close-up shot. They zoom in really well as he's talking, and it lingers there. It stays really, really close. I mean, his head doesn't even fit in the shot. It's so close. What would be the point of zooming in so close? From a director's perspective.
I mean, I think it's much more immersive, I'm trying to see how they get there. Yeah, so it's a shot they're using several times and then they zoom in on it, the same shot.
Okay.
Let's see, what's he saying at that very moment?
At that point, he's saying, in response to a terrorist incident, you asked for miracles, Theo. I give you. He's basically explaining his whole idea here. That's what he's doing, right?
Right. So that's why, they're calling more attention, minimizing any other distraction on the scene, on the screen. All you, it's for focus and immersion into what he's saying.
Okay, very cool. All right, so you have anything else you want to say about this minute?
No, I think it's a good one.
All right.
It's
Well,
all everything's
are there
kind
any bad minutes in Die Hard? Come on.
No, not really. Maybe the
Exactly.
credits. No, I'm just kidding.
No, the credits are great. The credits are great,
I'm just
and I will have you back for the credits if you
teasing.
want. If you want, you are welcome to come back for some of the credits.
Thank
If you're
you.
available, we'll see.
Thank you.
All right, so the script again has a few little changes here, not that many, but there's a few of them. So, McClane heard Al's story and says, "I'm sorry, I didn't mean to make a joke out of it." So that part they cut out. And then Powell says, "Hey, you couldn't know." And McClane goes, "I still feel like shit, as opposed to I feel like shit." That's the difference. And then Powell mentions the fact that the LAPD is not calling the shots anymore. Then we get McClane's reaction, but he doesn't mention that it's the feds. They never have that little interjection of McClane saying, "Feds, you got it." That they just completely cut out there. And then they have a shot of bad guys all sitting there listening. And in the movie, Theo's the one who says a time lock, but the actual in the script it's Hans. Theo doesn't just say anything. Doesn't say anything. He just looks on as Hans is mentioning it. That's all we got for the in the script. Every Tuesday we have a segment called Off the Beaten Track Holiday Edition, where my guest will give a little story, anecdote, adventure, misadventure, something that happened to them over the course of life, but something revolving around some sort of holiday. So what have you got for us, Dana?
Gosh, well, there's so many options, but so for, let's see, 2019 and 2021, I've been shooting, I shot a movie in 2019, and then it's called Dear Santa. And it's about all the letters.
I've seen it.
Woohoo! It's about all the letters that get sent to Santa every year that get put in the United States Postal Service and what happens to them. So we did a movie about letters in 2019. So we had to wait for all the letters to come in. So we had to shoot the entire movie basically between Thanksgiving and Christmas when all the letters come in, and we shot them. So it was very, very crazy. And so we shot all around America every day, basically between Thanksgiving and Christmas, following these letters and what happens to them. And it was really, really fun. And the better part of this is that I'm Jewish, and so I don't celebrate Christmas, but I love Christmas. And so my husband said, oh, not only do you get your fill of Christmas, but then after we shoot it, we get to work with the footage all year round. So we shot it 2019 when the pandemic happened. We were working on the film the entire, you know, winter, spring, summer, really into the fall. And then it came out in December. And then last year we were hired to do a series, the same thing. And so we've been working on that for the entire rest of the year. So now for like 2 years, I've had Christmas every single day, listening to Christmas music, working on Christmas all the time. So it's a long story, but basically we have Christmas all year round now, which I love.
Oh, wow. That's really cool. And, you know, I guess the best part about it is that your family wasn't concerned about the fact that you weren't around for Christmas since you don't celebrate.
No, exactly. It's great. I mean, it's a little
problematic. But how did that work? How did that work with everybody who was, you know, in the crew?
Yeah, no, it wasn't easy. So the first year, we really had to find, I mean, we do have a lot of Jewish crew members. That's helpful. But, you know, it gets hard.
Jews in Hollywood? Come on.
It gets hard when, you know, it's okay to do it for maybe for 1 year for some of them, but then now it's going on and we're waiting to find out if we're going to be doing a second season. So, you know, my business partner, she has three young children, and, you know, it's tough. One thing that happened the first year we realized was a lot less happens actually on Christmas than you think, because usually everything was fine up until Christmas Eve. And then it became like you had to really call in some favors to have people shooting on Christmas Eve. But most of the story was finished by Christmas Eve. So that was good. So last year, I don't even think we shot on Christmas Day. The year before we did, we shot in Times Square on Christmas, which was fun. And Christmas Eve, we did somewhere else. But sometimes we have like five crews going in different cities and different places, shooting all at once. So it's pretty exciting.
Wow. That's really
very
cool.
Very festive.
Yes. Very festive. Definitely the festivus for the rest of us, right?
Yes. And it's funny because I've never had Christmas lights, obviously. I've never bought any, but now in my attic, I have a treasure because everywhere we go, we bring Christmas lights and we string them up behind all of our shots. So like, it looks like double down.
And you have to keep them in your house?
I do have them in my house right now. They're not all here. I mean, because we stash them in New York. I'm in California. We stash them in New York. We stash them in Chicago. So we have them all around the country. So we don't have to be schlepping them everywhere we go. But I do have quite a lot of Christmas decorations now. I borrow them too from friends who have too many. We have a lot.
Oh, wow. Okay. Very cool. Yeah. All right. And unfortunately, since you're not going to be able to join us again tomorrow, so I decided that I'll let you do your Hans Hump Day today. You know, the tomorrow segment, which which we'll do with another guest again tomorrow, but you know, we'll still do the segment today where you'll give us your top five Alan Rickman performances.
Okay, so I'm gonna change it up a little because, you know, in looking through all his IMDb, it's been so long since I've seen them, but arguably my favorite movie of all time, like I just had mentioned, I'm obsessed with Christmas, and so like my top two movies in general are Love Actually, which I know is very controversial for a lot of people, and Serendipity. But he was in
Serendipity. Oh wow. I love that movie.
Oh yeah, you should do. If you do Serendipity, I can do the entire thing. I can go through every minute.
Well, let's put it this way. I know you, and I don't think you're going to have time to do this every week for like 5 months. I would love to do that with you, but I know
But
you
I
and
know a lot about that every minute. Anyway, so in Love Act, I'm gonna, instead of doing the top five movies, I'm gonna do my top five scenes in Love Actually with him.
Okay, you can cheat. You can cheat. Wait a second, one
So
second. Before we get there, so basically you're saying that Love Actually is the only movie that you love that you think Alan Rickman has a great performance in, or is there another one somewhere?
I mean, I have to just rewatch. Like, I just can't speak on them. I mean,
And what
I
about
would
this
think
movie
he's.
that we're talking about today?
No, he was great in this. Oh,
Okay, so
I forgot
how
I
would
wasn't
you
allowed to
rank?
do that one.
No, you were. So how would you rank those two? Love his performance in Love Actually and his performance in Die Hard. Just those two.
His performance was really great in this. I'd say probably this is better because he's so sinister. But it's more of like a one note performance in that, I don't mean that in a bad way. I just mean that he's a villain. And so villains are very like, not as nuanced to play, I would say. Whereas in Love Actually, he is just like really flawed. And he's taken along for this ride. If feels like by the secretary. And so like, but yet he plays a really good boss to Laura Linney's character. And so I think it's a little bit more layered in Love Actually than this, but this is a great performance as well.
So you would put Love Actually first, and then the second.
Yes.
Okay, that's fine. That's fair.
Yeah.
Okay, so now you can give us your top five Alan Rickman scenes in Love
Okay.
Actually. Start with number
Okay.
five and work your way up.
All right. But now I read a note and I don't remember what the note was. Okay. So I say my last, let's see. I'd say the fifth one is like when he first kind of interacts with his secretary. So he's kind of like taken in by her. He's sort of like dorky, but yet intrigued. I would say like dancing with his secretary is four. I'm trying to, I don't remember what I wrote this for. Let me come back to three because I have to figure out what that is. The Laura Linney scene where he's kind of like saying that, everybody knows you're in love with whatever the engineer's name is. Like, come on, just get on with it. He's like the loving kind of older brother slash boss. And the number one by far is him at the with Mr. Bean at the department store when he's the clerk is wrapping up the necklace and he's taking so long and making it perfect, but he's worried his wife is gonna come. And so he's very, very like, let's just get it done. Let's get it done. What are you gonna put yogurt on top of it? It's very funny. Oh, and the number three, I figured out what number three was, is the coming home scene at the very end when he comes back to Heathrow. And so like I love that scene because he comes in, he's sort of it's a very calm, subtle performance. But you're wondering the fact that he's back, does that mean they're separated and he's back, or like that they're together and he's back, and you can't tell. So it's a very subtle performance.
Okay, great. Very good. Thank you very much for that, Dana. Thank you for going out of the box. There you
No problem.
go. So, no problem. So, how would you how do you want how So, why don't you tell people how they can get in touch with you?
Sure, this one always gets me. It's harder than I think. But anyway, I guess dananachman.com.
Well, because you don't usually contact yourself, so that makes sense. It's the idea.
I
It's
know,
the same
right?
idea that sometimes people ask you what your phone number is, and you won't necessarily remember what your own phone number is because you don't call it.
That's true. I'd say dananachman.com is the best. Or you can find me on Instagram. I think it's just dana.nachman.
Okay, great.
Yeah.
And finding me is very simple. Just do a quick search for Movie Rob Minute. You can find me on Facebook. You can find me on Twitter. Or you can find me on my website, movierobminute.com. So, Dana, thank you very much for joining me yesterday and today. I'm sorry that your busy schedule won't let you come back the rest of the week. We'll try to
Well,
find
thank
someone
you
to
for.
do justice, in your place during that time. But hopefully, when I decide what I'm going to do next season, hopefully you know, you'll be willing to come back and talk about another movie. It probably won't be serendipity. We'll see. I'm still debating what I'm going to do. I'll you know,
Oh,
when
boo.
I know, I will inform you, and hopefully you'll be able to, you know, maybe you'll even get enough time to join us all week. We'll see.
Yes, sounds good.
Excellent.
Well,
All right.
thank you for having me.
No problem. So thank you very much, Dana, and until tomorrow, yippee-ki-yay.
Yippee-ki-yay.